figuring out how the story ends. But at that time, I guess I thought I was a lot more remarkable than I was.
Mother wasn't doing well in Florida. I realized that this was really the first time she'd truly been financially on her own in her life. Even during the brief periods between husbands, she'd had alimony or grandma's dead money to support her, as well as friends and family around her. That was all gone now. She couldn't seem to hold down a job at all, for the same reasons as her bartending days. There was always someone she couldn't tolerate, some cunt employee or boss that was an asshole or a moron. Always someone else's fault. I could tell she was scared, and sometimes I thought she was losing her bean altogether. She was working graveyard shift in a nursing home and would snivel about all these horrible patients she had to deal with. To make her point, she brought a mini cassette recorder along on one of her shifts to tape these awful patients she told me about. She mailed me the tape and I listened to it for about 15 minutes with my jaw on the floor. It was Mother crudely and menacingly trying to get some terrified old woman into a bathroom. "Please be gentle, you're hurting me." "Oh, shut up, I'm not hurting you, just sit down, Jesus Christ." "Please, just shut up." It was straight up elder abuse, and Mother honestly thought she was the victim, having to manhandle elderly dementia patients, like Ginger throwing a blind guy out of the bar. I tried gently to tell Mother that she was in the wrong, but she wouldn't hear it. I understand losing your cool in a frustrated moment, but to calculate, tape recording it, and then, with the benefit of hindsight, still justify it? I'd seen her afraid, courageous, meek, helpful, polite, and even rude. But being mean to the weakest of the weak and arguing, complaining even, that it's her job? That's what bad cops do. It's hard to look at your mother in that light. She was still doing local theater, and occasionally I'd float the idea that maybe she should move to LA and try her hand at acting out here. I was still developing a show and had gone so far as to write in characters based on Mother, Mitch, and Christine. They'd partnered me with a writer named Stan Daniels, who'd gotten his start writing for The Dean Martin Show, and had gone on to win Emmys for The Mary Tyler Moore Show and then Cheers. You think my references are dated? This was 1996. I was 29. Stan Daniels was 62, but he might as well have been 106. We'd write at his house in the valley, underneath his shelf of Emmys. In the script, he'd have me quoting Immanuel Kant. I had to ask who that was. I had to know the references before I could understand that the jokes weren't funny. At one point in the script, he has Christine's character going to the bathroom to get me Mercurochrome, an antiseptic popular when my elderly father was a child, for a cut on my hand. Even spell check puts a red squiggly line under it when you type it. That's how dated a reference it is. I wanted to tell Stan, "Why don't you just have her say she's going to apply the leeches?" But instead, I just shut up and looked at the Emmys. What did I know? Every sitcom on television sucked as far as I was concerned. Mad About You? Suddenly Susan? Third fucking Rock from the Sun? How could I tell what they thought was good? Maybe our shitty sitcom was exactly the kind of suck Hollywood was craving. I did the Florida Comedy Festival in 1997 in Jacksonville. Mother came out, but made me come pick her up. She wouldn't make the 2.5-hour drive by herself, preferring me to drive 5 hours round trip to come get her and bring her there. She was suddenly too scared to drive, too scared of getting lost. It didn't matter that I was coming from across the country with a head full of material to put together. That chapped my onion for a minute, but once we were there, she went straight into vulgar and hilarious, not your typical mother mode. She opened one of my shows with the same shtick from Santa Ana and killed. The festival included a competition night as the finale. The contestants had been pre-selected, and I wasn't one of them. But there was a wild card spot up for grabs for the best of the fest from the week ramping up to it. I thought I had it nailed, but was informed that I wouldn't be eligible because you had to be TV clean to do the competition. When I assured them that I could work clean, they caved in and gave me the spot. As the wild card entry, I had to open the show, the shit spot, taking the bullet. I was still riding a TWA Flight 800 bit from the previous summer. The flight that blew up or was shot down over Long Island. It was a particularly cruel piece berating the families of the victims for putting undue pressure on an overworked medical examiner to identify bodies, him trying his best to piece together body parts like Mr. Potato Head's. The story was just old enough that an audience could overlook the initial savagery and see the righteousness inherent at the core. I had to change one necessary motherfucker to mother trucker. But otherwise, as bombastic as the subject matter was, it remained TV clean. Like the Doug Flutie flipper baby, it was never going to be on Letterman. But it crushed, and I won the competition as a huge underdog with mother there to see it. Unlike in San Francisco, I had my biggest fan to celebrate with. We tore that night down like we were king and queen of the prom. Before the end of the festival, I took a day to go up to Florida State Prison in Rayford, Florida, less than an hour away, to drop in on Victor on death row. After being thoroughly searched and then undertaking the menacing walk through a chain-link cage passageway across the yard, death row turned out to be pretty relaxed, at least in the visiting area. It wasn't sitting on a phone looking through a safety window like you'd imagine. I didn't have to press my tits up against the glass while Victor masturbated like Brad Davis's character in Midnight Express, though I would have just for the story. Death row visiting was a large room with about 15 stainless steel tables with four seats each, all affixed to the floor. Inmates were dressed in orange jumpsuits, but otherwise uncuffed and free to walk about. Most of the tables were full and everyone was laid back, if not almost festive. These guys don't get out very often and visits are rare, so everyone was on their best behavior and jovial. You could tell immediately that Victor was a known goof and a charmer. He shot jokes back and forth to other inmates and guards who'd always smile. There were vending machines, and we loaded up on junk food. He introduced me around. He'd lean in and point out different prisoners and whisper to me who and how they murdered, who he did and didn't like, who was going to die next, etc. Death row gossip. We were like silly women. As for Victor's case, he'd been outside a bar in Lake City, Florida, and asked two women sitting inside a car for a ride. They refused, rudely according to Victor. Being new to town, he did what most people would do. He shot them both. They both lived and probably still don't pick up hitchhikers. He then carjacked another car with a couple inside. The guy fled and Victor took off with the girl still in the car. A police chase ensued and he wrapped the car around a tree at 70 miles per hour, killing the girl. Felony murder. Any felony resulting in the death of another person was a capital crime. He'd been on death row for 7 years. Now we're eating vending machine Pop-Tarts while I snuck into the bathroom for an occasional smoke. Life goes on, for a limited time only. I hung out for longer than I could come up with conversation. I knew he'd rather sit around with nothing to say than go back to his cell. They offered Polaroid pictures for $5 a shot, just like they used to do with featured titty dancers at strip clubs. We got a couple of shots before I left, one with him pretending to choke me. He'd later tell me he'd almost got written up for playing along. On death row, I can't imagine what the punishment would be. After the festival, Mother and I went back to Crystal River for a few days. I went to visit her at work overnight at the nursing home. That was the real death row. Victor's death row in a prison was a bachelor party compared to the elderly and infirmed at night in the nursing facility. Moans echoed down otherwise silent corridors along with the rhythmic beeping of machines. People who'd been there for years with strokes, dementia, lost and in pain. Bedpans and catheters, fed through tubes. Just like on death row, they were incubated in small rooms with a small television and probably just as few visitors. If family did visit, they probably went unrecognized. No need for bars or fences when you can't even walk. So-and-so just broke a hip and that guy keeps pulling his tube out. Occasional shrieks from pains or night terrors. And that's your reward for 97 years of good, clean living. It was gruesome. It didn't excuse Mother's treatment of the patients, but like the prison guards on death row and living in that shitty town just outside the razor wire, you could see where it would drive you into a depression, sadism, or insanity. Anyone who says that suicide is never the answer hasn't heard all of the questions.
Hey, reader. Let's take a minute for ourselves. I'm going to read you the back cover, which no one reads on an audiobook. It says, "Praise for Doug Stanhope." There's a nice one that Louis C.K. wrote. You have to buy the book to see that because he wrote that for the book. But other ones we just stole. Sarah Silverman. "Dear Jews who run show business, please give Doug Stanhope a primetime show." She didn't write that for the book. She tweeted that. We fucking stole it.
It's weak. Also, Doug might be the most important stand-up working today from Ricky Gervais. Also a tweet. Is it Gervais or Gervais? I don't fucking know. I've never met the guy. He tweeted that once. They stole it for the back of the book. Thank you, Ricky Gervais, for the tweet. And my favorite, not stolen, written in the Times of London, Doug Stanhope is a visionary douchebag. One of my favorite things ever.
Chapter 16, Breakdown Dead Ahead. When I got back to L.A., Christine was getting ready to leave on a last-minute trip to London, Paris, and then on to the Cannes Film Festival. She did a lot of gallivanting like this, but never with me. She was being invited to dinner with Rod Stewart or a weekend with one of the Kennedys. O.J. Simpson was an old friend who'd flown her to a Super Bowl once when she was a young actress. Just after he was acquitted, he called her to go out on a date. As possessive as I may have been, I could only laugh at the absurdity of that showdown. Hey, stay away from her, dude. She's with me now. Hey, anyone seen my sunglasses? She didn't return his call. Christine would show up occasionally at my gigs on the road and in L.A., but when she took off on some global excursion, I was never invited. Now she's going to Cannes where some big-shot ex-fling of hers was going to be. I was leaving to drive across country on a 7-week tour. I was resentful and being petty. She said that she wasn't sure where our relationship was headed. Something to that effect. Pre-dump chatter. I smelled it. The writing was on the wall and on the windshield for that 2,400-mile drive across country. Like when my wife Dory had left me without warning and disappeared on that drive from Vegas. This is from a letter to Victor. Poolside in Charlotte, North Carolina. Drove here. Left Friday, stayed Saturday and Sunday in Tulsa. Got here Tuesday a.m. Thought about the girl the whole way. Torture. In France, out and about with the rich and famous. Right where she belongs, right where I want to be. But not as someone's guest. I need to be the celebrity. Otherwise, it's all tinged with jealousy. 2,400 miles with nothing but painted white lines and the fear. I've brought the fear on myself, I presume, but there's no backtracking, just miles more to go, weeks more to wait. I left L.A. with only the knowledge that she was somewhere unreachable in the south of France, in the same place as her famous longtime lover, and that I wasn't invited. Just enough knowledge that it was easily transformed by the road into a cancer that spread with each mile. Was she now being helicoptered to his palace, so enamored by his status and his title that no mention of me ever crossed her lips, no thought of me, not a glimpse of me in her mind? Another border, another rest stop. Was she wondering how to break it to me, that she'd decided to snub me for her old flame? Another mile. Should I leave her now as a preemptive strike? Could I bear to feel this way again? Not only jealous and untrusting, but also ashamed to feel this way to boot. Do I feel this way because I have no faith in my own constitution if the roles were reversed? My hypocrisy is thick enough. 100 miles under my belt and still no messages. My imagination run wild, exhausted. I picture finding her and her ex on the cover of the National Enquirer, his 14 inches of cock laying across both of her outstretched palms. An insert photo of me, little-dicked and pot-bellied, with a tear in my eye. Sunday afternoon, she calls. No idea why I've left so many panicked messages. There is no way to explain what the hours can do in your mind, how thoughts can manifest into realities, how imagination can run free and turn ugly on you, especially with a guilty mind. He hadn't stolen her away. In fact, he'd snubbed her on the phone. No danger, no imminent collapse, not even an understanding of why this fear had come about. It's not hers to comprehend. I could have just written, wow, I blew that shit out of proportion like a fucking moron, but that wouldn't have sounded so despondently tragic. I'd been completely out of my mind on that trip. I left dozens of needy, helpless messages on her voicemail, begging her to call. I even actually looked at tabloids and truck stops, all just to finally get a "what the fuck is your problem" call from France. The next week, I was back in Florida and I visited Victor again. That night, I stayed over with one of his legal aides and I called Christine, who was back in LA. She said she doesn't know what she's doing with her life and she doesn't feel like she's my girlfriend anymore. She doesn't think she's in love with me anymore, but she loves me and doesn't want to lose me, and I'm her best friend, but it's not going to be like it was, and she just doesn't know. I was getting dumped. I fucking knew it. How can you do that to a guy alone out on the road, banging his death row buddy's legal staffer? Have you no soul? I drove 12 hours through the night from Florida to Texas, where I had 3 nights off before my next gig. I spent $600 on a last-minute flight to L.A., about what I was making for the Texas gigs, to see her face-to-face. When I got back to L.A., she came to the apartment. I asked her if she'd seen her ex. She said that she had. I asked her point blank, "Did you fuck him?" She said no. But then she said that other things had happened. Why couldn't you just stop at no? Technically, that wouldn't be lying. We were done. It didn't matter that I'd cheated on her every possible chance I got on the road. She wasn't the type to ask a lot of questions. But those were just road girls. My sewer-grade infidelities couldn't compete with global A-listers. I can't tell you who he is, but I'll tell you what he does for a living. He's the... Now I had to fly back out for 5 more weeks of horrible road work in redneck hell with all that shit in my head. There's things you don't do. You don't be cruel to animals, you don't hit a woman, and you don't dump a guy when he's on the road. I guess with my torturing caterpillars and punching my stepsister, I had it coming. I've had plenty of nosedive, wayward, tanked sets in my career, but I can't imagine anyone deserving a refund more than any poor chump who had to witness my sullen and morose act on the rest of that trip.
By the time I got back to L.A., I'd slightly recovered, and if only out of spite, I went in search of anything and everything I could drop my cock into. I went on a tsunami of poon, and not all of it horrible. One, in fact, was quite fantastic. I was standing in front of a nightclub called Union, waiting for it to open for a show I was doing that night. They were late in opening, and a few people were gathered out front, including one girl who had to have been the most beautiful girl I'd ever seen. She was alone and asked me for a cigarette. The attraction tripled. I started drumming up some small talk, just bullshit, asking who she was here to see, hoping it wasn't a comic that sucked. Nothing worse than shitty comics getting beautiful girls. Her name was Renee. We carried our conversation to the bar, and I was emboldened when she kept up or ahead of my drinking. She didn't fuck around. She was 22 and had just moved down from Oregon to get into acting. That's usually a horrible sign, but she seemed as apathetic about the business as I did. L.A. was just a place you had to show up and tolerate. The show started, and we watched together from the bar. She laughed, or more importantly, didn't laugh at all the right times. I never told her that I was a comedian, much less that I was going on. I just waited until they announced me from the stage and excused myself. "Hang on, I'll be back in 10 minutes. Smooth. I killed. I came off stage, sat back down, and ordered us another round as though nothing had happened in my absence. If I couldn't close this lead, I didn't deserve the paper. I took her to the Coach and Horses. Everybody hit on her. I was afraid to leave to take a leak. We were drunk quick, and she came back to my place. I woke up to a note and a phone number. I was afraid to call. I knew from the road that sometimes you weren't always the only one waking up and making fun of your poor drunken choices from the night before. Renee was the rebound girl, and sometimes you cling to the rebound with 10 times the zeal as the relationship you're recovering from. I guarded myself from going overboard, but I would have moved her into my apartment that day if I had the option. She was living with 3 girlfriends just on the other side of the coach and quickly became a regular there. And while I'd see her often, I could never quite nail her down. I tried to be cool about it. She was eerily taciturn and secretive about her life, like she may be part of some covert organization or touched inappropriately as a child. I often wondered if she was some high-class call girl on the side. Either way, it gave her an air of mystery that piqued my curiosity to levels that could easily be confused with love. She would command the attention of any room she was in without saying a word. She also had a habit of having to be carried out of the bar. I didn't have the upper body strength. The coach was changing. Ginger had been fired after 17 years. All the regulars knew she was unemployable otherwise and worried what would become of her. There were a few Bigfoot sightings of her sitting at bus benches but not waiting for a bus. She called me once to hint at her staying in my apartment. I remember that day because that was the day I bought caller ID. April was the new bartender. She was young and cute, very cheerleader sweet and peppy. That was great, but it also turned a genuine dive bar into a dive trendy, seemingly overnight. Young, hip, and cool people now started filling up the seats without our caustic Ginger to scare them off. "This isn't a bus stop," was sorely lacking. It was becoming wall to wall without her. The small handful of regulars crushed into the back corner and none too pleased about it. Some nights it would get so overfull that I'd bar back for free just to get out of the crowd. I'm very claustrophobic. One night, Janine Garofalo was sitting at a booth with some other people, including SNL's Chris Kattan. She came to the bar while I was back washing glasses and asked me if I could stop one of the drunk patrons, a regular, from bothering Kattan. I told her very calmly and honestly, "I don't work here," as I continued washing dishes behind the bar. She rolled her eyes at me like I was the biggest shitbag in the world. Working for a living is admirable in most parts of the country, but in L.A., in show business, it's looked at as a disease. There's a reason they say, don't quit your day job. A day job means things aren't working out. It was funny when comedians who knew me peripherally would come into the coach and see me loading beer into the coolers. I was supposed to be this new hot property in L.A. What happened? They'd look at me sadly like they'd walked in on me masturbating with crippled hands. I never explained. I was still getting nowhere with Renee, and it made me crazy that she was now part of my bar but still a free agent. She flirted in a one-of-the-guys kind of way that made her all the more appealing to everybody. There was one guy named Lorca who was a semi-regular. There were three kinds of regulars at the coach. The ones you hugged when you walked in, the ones you high-fived, and the ones you nodded at. Lorca was a nodder. He was also a leering, dour drunk, probably in his mid-20s, who always seemed to be on the edge of a fist fight. He also seemed to be sitting with Renee quite a bit. One night I'd been playing cat and mouse with him and Renee. They'd be sitting together, and when he'd wander off, I'd jump in and steer her my way. Becker and Ralphie May showed up at some point. They knew my infatuation with this girl. Renee and Lorca were both as shit-faced as I was. In my mind, it was a Mexican standoff for who was going to leave with her. A few times I caught him glaring at me. I couldn't discern if he was trying to stare me down or if he was just wasted. I'm against violence, as are most people who aren't good at it, and the mere hint of it in his eyes had me on edge. Ralphie and Becker, also big paranoids, convinced me that, yes, he was overtly being a dick. Still, he hadn't done anything outright to warrant me saying something to him. I'd be hard-pressed to take him aside and say, "Quit being creepy." So I just allowed it to silently ruin my night. I hated being a coward, and I also hated being so deluded by a girl that I couldn't tell if I needed to be brave in the first place. Finally, April called last call, and shortly after, we were all invited to get the fuck out. The bar cleared out onto the street. Ralphie, Becker, and I walked out the door and turned left up the sidewalk. Lorca, a few steps behind, ran right out into Sunset Boulevard and was killed by a speeding car. It knocked him literally out of his shoes. I didn't expect the night to end like that either.
Renee and I lost touch, and somehow I was back together with Christine. I don't know how it happened. You've had those relationships. You don't know how they happened. They just seem to go away and then recur like herpes. I was never much for being single, or faithful for that matter. I've always been with a girl except for the 3 years I lived on the road, and those girls went by like mile markers. And I fell in love with a lot of those girls, too. My TV pilot died, but that just meant another pilot was going to happen. You switch writers, pitch a different network, find a new production company. Even with a brand new concept, every pilot I pitched still included characters for Christine, Mitch, and Mother. When HBO's pilot for NBC shit the bed, they also dumped my half-hour special. I still got paid, but I would have much rather have had the show than the money. My stand-up was doing really good, but the rest of the LA nonsense just seemed to drag. I sucked at acting, and it didn't help that I was getting sent to auditions for parts I had no business playing. I hated auditions. Actors are generally horrible, empty, vapid people, and writers install temporary personalities into their voids. You go to an audition and it's a room full of desperation, as though three lines for some insurance commercial is the sole donated kidney and everyone in the lobby needs the transplant to live. It got to the point where I knew I was going to suck and I just had to get through it. A lot of times I'd read for the same casting agents for different things, and even they knew I was going to suck. I could always get a laugh in the room, but never with the lines I had to read. Outside the room was a different story. You try cracking a joke to break the tension in a room full of actors preparing, you might as well be flinging shit in their hair. I'd been cracking wise outside of some audition and getting glared at by the half dozen other guys in the room. I'd stopped giving a fuck. The audition was for a single sentence, something generic like, "Looks like you're going to need a new transmission." Everyone's going to read the same stupid sentence, and somehow I'm fucking up your mojo by trying to add a little levity to the waiting room. I got called in to read. The casting lady knew me from stand-up showcases and really liked me, but she'd also auditioned me several times before, and I always fell flat. In an audition, you're in a small room with a casting person and usually one or two other humps with clipboards and one guy filming you. I said the line. They stared at me like I'm out of focus. They asked me to read it again. How many fucking ways can you read that? It's a simple sentence. There's no context. I read it again exactly the same. Then I got the ubiquitous, "Thanks, we'll let you know." Knowing the woman and being fairly friendly, I said, "Hey, I know I'm not getting the part, but will you guys do me one favor? All those assholes out there are acting like they're about to play the new Batman. So the second I open the door to leave, will you give me a huge, screaming, foot-stomping round of applause like I just blew the roof off the place?" They looked at each other and started to smile. I'm sure they were tired of the monotony of 1,000 douchebags saying the same benign sentence. They agreed. I opened the door back into that funeral parlor in the lobby, and an extended, bellowing, riotous, screaming roar followed me out. I turned around and took a couple half bows and a wave as I backed out of the room. The actors sat slack-jawed and incredulous. One of them asked me, "What did you do?" I just offered a cunty shrug and a "good luck" and walked out of the place. The final straw came when I was given a script for a lead role in a feature film. If it wasn't "Dude, Where's My Car?", which I'm pretty sure it was something equally inane. My agent handed it to me like it was The Godfather. I sat that night with Mitch at the coach and tried to read my lines to him. I wasn't trying to act them out, mind you. I was just reading them to show how utterly embarrassing they were to even say out loud. I was horrified that I'd actually have to deliver this mucus in front of strangers like it was funny. I drank heavily. We kept going through the script, finding more lines even worse than the ones before. At some point, Mitch casually said, "Yeah, just don't do it." I'd honestly never considered this. I always just did what I was told to do in LA. It never dawned on me I could simply say, "No, thank you." What a beautiful drunken epiphany. In the morning, I called my agent and said I wasn't going to the audition, that it just wasn't for me. The phone fell silent like I'd just thrown a stack of cash into a campfire. I didn't want to act. I wanted to be doing stand-up. All these auditions were doing was making me depressed. I remember telling Mitch that night in an embarrassing voice of drunken pomposity, "I don't even want to act. I want to be so real that someday people want to play me." Oh, the arrogance of fear mixed with alcohol. Regardless, the sentiment was true. I hated acting. Acting was Mother's thing. She loved this shit. She should be out here doing this.
Chapter 17, Mother's Big Move. I did a routine on one of my recordings about moving my mother to L.A. If you heard the bit, I chalked it all up to one drunken phone call. Stand-up comedy doesn't allow time for detail. The reality is that it was probably several drunken phone calls over a period of time, but I did achieve my goal. I flew out to pick up Mother on May 4th, 1998. We rented a U-Haul truck that we would tow her car behind. Mother was an agitated wreck. She had piles of shit in and out of boxes, and she was frantic. She wasn't even close to ready, and me being in a hurry made her even more sniping and abrasive. Where we were going to put all this rummage when we got to L.A. was another problem, but we'd deal with that when we got there. Most of the shit she was bringing was completely unnecessary, but there was no telling her that. The cats were cordoned off into one bedroom so they wouldn't run off while we loaded the truck. They were used to being free-range cats and weren't happy about being locked in a room. They didn't realize it was only going to get worse. All the way to L.A. in cat carriers. Solitary confinement. I was terrified at the idea of just having to drive the U-Haul, much less towing the car on the back. Fortunately, what I lack in driving skills, I more than compensate for in stamina. My record nonstop drive at that point was 27 hours. I figured we could make this in 48 hours in a straight shot with Mother only having to take the wheel when I needed to grab a couple hours to recharge. Boy, was I fucking wrong. Mother didn't take the wheel once, although she might as well have been driving with all her usual invisible brake stomping and other gesticulations and critiques. I was a lot more patient then than I would be now, but even then I was getting pretty fucking irritated very quickly. The cats were stacked in carriers behind us and were constantly yowling. Mother kept hinting that we should get a motel at some point later for the night, and as I ignored her, the hints turned into demands. We'd barely made it 8 or 9 hours before we were checking into some off-ramp trucker motel. This didn't mean simply stopping to sleep. It entailed finding a motel, unloading our own shit, me a toothbrush, her a suitcase, a pocketbook the size of a suitcase, a cooler, her bags of snacks, etc., etc. Then we'd have to sneak 7 cat carriers up to the room, as well as cat food and a litter box. Motels may be pet-friendly, but this was starting your own no-kill shelter, and you could hear the cacophony from the parking lot. In the morning, I realized that I'd fucked up and parked in a way that would force me to back out in a very complicated fashion. It's one thing to tow a car, but I have no idea how to angle it in reverse. After the same clusterfuck of getting the cats and all our shit reloaded back into the truck, I gave several frustrated attempts at getting out of the parking lot, each more fucked up than the next. Then it dawned on me. Mother can do it. She was a truck driver. She's trained to do this. But Mother didn't, or just wouldn't. She wouldn't even make an attempt. I can only assume now that Mother's trucking days were mostly spent when her partner let her drive on long straightaways, like letting your kids steer the car in an empty parking lot from your lap. Eventually, I flagged down a trucker leaving the motel to get it turned around for me. We'd end up getting a motel every night. Along with having to stop to pee every 2 hours, my 48-hour trip lasted 5 days, and I knew I'd probably just bitten off a huge chunk of mistake.
The apartment was filled up with Mother's debris to the point of breaking before we'd unloaded even close to half of the U-Haul. The rest of her shit would have to go into storage until after she got her own place, something she wasn't eager to discuss. Anytime the talk turned to setting her up on her own in either a job or an apartment, she went into her own 5 stages of manipulation. Ignore, dodge, barter, panic, and finally cry, but never acceptance. But I like it here. So Mother started building her nest. She preferred to stay in the living room on the bunk bed because she wanted to be in front of the TV. Then she had her table with her ashtray and her 32-ounce travel mug of diet soda, mainstays. Then her tissue box, where used tissues overflowed and spread like dust bunnies. Then assorted snacks, M&Ms, as well as pens, post-it notes, TV guides, alarm clock, lighters, and cat toys until she was completely enveloped in her own semicircle of comfort refuse. The nest then spread to my desk, which was just a folding banquet table. Here she set up her makeup table that could have painted a circus. Plastic drawers, hand mirrors, double-sided table mirrors, hairbrushes, eyelash curlers, all that shit. I didn't have a lot of stuff to begin with, which is good because I'd have been overrun. The good news for my relationship, whatever state that was in by now, was that Christine was deathly allergic to cats and couldn't come inside anymore. She didn't hang around much at the apartment beforehand anyway, but usually spent the night. Now she could only talk through the screen door. That was fine by all parties involved. I wasn't dying for Christine to spend a lot of time with Mother. Even when I did find Mother's eccentricities amusing, and I didn't right around now, it wasn't Christine's sense of humor. Christine was all Hollywood and could plaster on a fake smile in order to game show host her way through any type of social situation. I'd even brought her up to Crouch, Idaho once to a barbecue with some of the old Mountain Man Dirty Shame saloon folk, and she had them eaten out of her hand. But she wasn't going to be doubled over laughing at Mother jacking off cats and cranking out farts. Mother hated Christine right away. She said she was a phony, and she might have been correct, especially if you think being polite and smiling when you really want to say you repulse me on every level of humanity is being a fake. It was the only girlfriend I remember Mother disliking, and the timing made it stand out. I don't know if it was territorial or if she didn't like that Christine didn't put enough effort into listening to her run-on stories and playing the daughter-in-law part, but their paths didn't cross often enough for it to become an issue. The funny twist was that in all this time, I had never once been in Christine's house. Christine also lived with her mother, and her mother wouldn't allow strangers in. The only time I'd met her mother is once when Christine brought her to my place for dinner. I remember spending a long afternoon trying to de-porn the place. All the accoutrements and decorations in my apartment were obscene to the point it was hard for me to recognize all the things that could be upsetting. My refrigerator alone was covered in smut. There was a centerfold of a naked 400-pound lady from some obese porn magazine that Mother had sent. A cutout picture of a woman with her knees at her ears and a large yellow onion stuffed halfway up her asshole. A snapshot of Joey Coco Diaz slinging his Cuban uncut egg roll off the bunk bed. Every time I thought I was done cleaning up, I'd spot something else. Oh, the inflatable sex sheep on the top bunk. The penis pump over the wine bottle in the front window. It was all just normal bric-a-brac to me, and hiding it all was my only focus. Funny that I was never bothered about the fact that I couldn't cook. Now, because of our mothers, neither Christine or I could go to the other's place. An excerpt from a letter to Victor. Mom is settling in like an old dog taken from the pound, scared, unsure, needy for attention, yet still stuck in her old ways. The TV is on around the clock. She panics every time she has to leave the house alone. Gives me puppy dog eyes when I leave for the bar, asking if I'm coming home. Takes it as though she's a burden when I don't, but she'll grow out of it. Hopefully sooner rather than later. Otherwise, I'll have to have you give her a car ride. The cats are going to be a problem, at least until they die, and considering the way she pampers them, that may never happen. Those cats may well live to be 100, walking around with artificial legs, IVs on rollers, plastic heart valves, others living in oxygen tents on life support systems, with nurses round the clock. I'm only afraid that one day it'll be discovered that I have the same blood type as one of these little house rodents, and I'll have to spare a kidney or a lung. Most of the herd of vermin should have been dead years ago. One looks like a burn victim, one's blind in one eye, some are missing fur. They look like they just did a tour of duty in the NAM. And Mom will sit around all day talking to them. And when she's not talking to them, she's talking about them. She'll sit there with stacks of photos of her cats laying around in different places and make you look at them. All the while, the actual cats are laying around in different places right there in the room. Ma, if I want to see Charlie sleeping on a box, I can just look over there. I don't need a fucking picture. Don't misunderstand me, Victor. She's got good qualities, but there aren't jokes in the good ones. In fact, there aren't any jokes in me at all anymore. This woman has sucked all the funny right out of me. She talks so fucking much that half my friends are afraid to call. I should give her your address. She'd bore you to death quicker than you could say old Sparky. She can do nothing for 6 hours and then spend six more hours telling you about it. A lot of this would eventually wind up in my act. I'm still not sure if I was trying out material on Victor or getting the material from the letters I'd write. Probably some of both. He was like my personal private open mic. It was time to lay out ground rules for Mother, just like I got when I moved in with her in Florida when I was 18. I understand you're chasing a dream, but you still have to look for a job. I can't be paying for everything. Get rid of all this unnecessary shit, and for fuck's sake, find a place to live. I was more than willing to help her look. In fact, I looked for her when I saw she wasn't looking at all. Finding a place in LA that's going to take seven cats was going to be difficult. Finding one I could afford would be nearly impossible, and Mother wasn't scrambling to find work. I was fully aware of Mother's manipulations, and she was very aware that I'd generally cave in. But not on living with me in a one-bedroom apartment. She'd had visions that we'd just sit around together on the bunk bed, watch TV, and read National Enquirers together like when I was 18 and I lived with her in Crystal River. Now I had a whole world of comics and comedy clubs, bars and parties, girls and a girlfriend on the side. I had meetings and lunches, for fuck's sake. Can't be hanging around the homestead farming cats. I got shit going on. I stayed away as much as possible. I had a good amount of road work that summer, giving her time to settle in on her own and figure out the neighborhood. In July, I got a hand job from God. The apartment two doors down was opening up, and it was also rent controlled. I jumped on it. Not only was it vagrant cheap, but I was still within shouting distance from Mother. And still, she couldn't understand why I'd want to move out when I'd still only be literally 25 feet away. I think she liked cock-blocking me from Christine. The sad fact was that I had to ask Christine for the money to move in. It killed me, but she knew it was a miracle find, and we probably hadn't had a place to fuck since Mother got there. I eventually paid her back. It just took me 15 years. My manager, Mark Lano, taught both acting and comedy classes, and he took Mother into both. Shortly afterwards, they signed her as a client. I hadn't figured out the whole LA scene quite yet, but there was no mistaking that this was just a polite gesture on their behalf, and I appreciated it. It gave Mother something to do. She was pretty good getting on the ball acting-wise, getting headshots and resumes made up right away, but anything that involved her leaving the house by herself was fraught with terror. I understood on some level. LA can be overwhelming to anyone, and after a dozen years in a place like Crystal River, it had to seem like utter bedlam. She started submitting herself for parts in the local acting rags, mostly student films and the like. Her first audition was in September, and she got the part in a short film as the mother of a breast cancer survivor. It didn't pay anything, but I was not that much of a prick that we didn't celebrate. I'd never gotten an acting role, and I'd been to shitloads of auditions. Money was tight, but maybe she could actually do this. What she couldn't do was stand-up comedy, and unfortunately, through Mark's class, she was trying. Her class did their final set live at the Improv in front of a real crowd. I wished I'd faked cancer to get out of seeing it. She stumbled and stammered her way through jokes that would have still died even if she nailed them. The premises were predictable. PMS versus menopause, growing up in the 50s and 60s, bad TV commercials. A lot of it was personal, and she even made reference to her first suicide attempt at 14. It just wasn't funny.
I couldn't even offer the fake chuckles of her classmates, the ones she gave me when I was bombing. It takes a lot of courage to walk out on that stage, and I wished my mother didn't have that courage. She could be very funny. Offstage, people would always tell her, "Now I know where Doug gets it from." Not that night. This was like the bloody miscarriage of the audition I did for Mother's Play in Florida. Not that she'd ever make that analogy out loud. Not even if I was dead and she were writing a book. Now, I know this probably makes me look like an unsupportive dick, but I was supportive. I just knew that no matter your pedigree, you can't make someone stage funny in a class. Mark Lano didn't even have pedigree. He owned a comedy club. He didn't perform in it. While I loved him for pretending to give a fuck about Mother, I knew she couldn't write a joke to save her life. I tried to help her, but save for just writing her an act, there's nothing I could do. I couldn't write from the perspective of a 50-some-year-old woman, and if you can't write on your own, there's no point in even doing this. Even if I could write it, stand-up is different than acting on stage. I always found it curious that Mother could act in a play but fell apart doing her own material. I could do stand-up, but I couldn't act. It feels too phony. Maybe that's where actors find some kind of shield. Maybe for Mother, stand-up felt too real. She took another stab at comedy. This time it was at the Union on Sunset where I'd met Renee, where I was a regular. I just hoped she wouldn't be as horrible. I gave her some tags to shore up her jokes and massage some of the verbiage in her bits. Before the show, someone came up to me and said that comedian Joe Rogan from the show News Radio was coming down to see me. He heard that I was funny and of a like mind and wanted to see my show. I'd met famous folk over Christine's shoulder, but never because they sought me out. Mother went on stage and was dead in her first sentence. She forgot where she was immediately and never recovered. A minute into her collapse, I saw Joe Rogan's head, a smaller version back then, poke through the door. I ran over to run interference. I didn't want him seeing this. I introduced myself. "Did someone say that's your mother?" he said, transfixed by the spectacle on the stage. Let's go outside and talk. Probably wasn't as bad as I remember, or it was as bad as I remember, but I'm probably the only one that thought it was that bad. Seeing your mother suck at what you're known for right in front of you and your peers is fucking excruciating. Mother stopped doing stand-up to focus on acting. I applauded her decision. I had to talk to her about getting a job several times, sometimes calmly, but mostly irate. My free network money was gone, and even though our rents were cheap, it was still double the rent. Every classified section and actor's rag had ads for people to do medical testing, so I talked her into being a lab rat. If she wouldn't work, then she could be a guinea pig. She did a few of those trials. I have no idea what for, but she never grew an extra limb or got gigantism like I'd secretly hoped. Eventually, she got a job at our favorite thrift store, the Out of the Closet on Fairfax. What better place for a hoarder to not just get a job, but an employee discount? Shit, she could have been setting the prices for all I know. Every dead cat was replaced by thousands of pieces of junk or clothing she didn't need. But she got it for $1.50. And do you know what these things cost new? Even though now I had my own apartment, Mother stayed on in that bargain basement bunk bed I'd left behind, which only exacerbated her chronic back pain. Her bedroom was now being filled up with her thrift shop treasure. You never know when you might get an audition and need a security guard outfit for wardrobe, and it was only $3. The worst was when you actually did need something randomly and she had it. One D-cell battery would justify all of her clutter and she'd rub it in. Fuck it. Wasn't my problem anymore. Once I no longer had to live with her and she was working, we got along pretty well. She was there to handle the bills when I was on the road, and I could wait until I had enough beer when I got home to go listen to her bitch ad nauseum about her facile world.
As I started selling CDs and later DVDs and t-shirts on my website, she'd take care of shipping the merchandise. Fans knew the merch was authentic, as the t-shirts would all be covered in cat hair and reek of cigarette smoke. This also gave her the opportunity to force my product on any living human being she came into contact with. Mailman, cable guy, her co-workers, anybody at all would be forced to take a recording of my act. If she came into contact with them again, she'd haunt them for reviews. I'd love to get that email from a fan who only knew of me because he was fixing Mother's plumbing and she jammed my CD into his toolbox. Our apartments were on the second floor of a two-story building facing the street, motel style, with one apartment in between hers and mine. It was loud, no question, and Mother never did adjust. The traffic made her crazy. Anyone playing music in the building was contemptible. The dog across the street would bark constantly. Its owners would constantly yell at the dog, and Mother would scream back at the owner. Street parking was rough, but to Mother it was a prison fight. You had to move your car every week on street sweeping days, Monday on one side, Tuesday on the next. Some old prick that lived around the corner owned a gargantuan early 60s tub of shit jalopy the size of a parade float that he never actually drove, save for reparking it in choice spots before street sweeping. It made Mother livid, and I was with her on this one. One day I noticed he'd parked barely an inch behind a car across the street with an open space behind it. I ran out and pulled my car not an inch behind his, knowing he'd be coming out to move it across the street before morning to avoid the ticket. We watched through the window when he showed up and assessed the situation with all the slapstick of a silent movie. Checked the front car, walked back, and checked the room to the back car. Scratch his head angrily, get behind the wheel, get back out and do the whole thing over again, looking around for someone to blame. Finally, he started the beast, and we laughed like fools watching him make some 75-point turn over a good 15 minutes to free himself. He never parked where he could get blocked in again, but still continued to clog up coveted spaces. Now Mother and I just went old school, and we'd sit up on the outside rail in front of our apartments, raining eggs down on his car. A lot of people say their parent is like their best friend, but when you're 32 and you're egging cars with your mother, with tears of laughter rolling down your faces, it really feels that way, because that's the kind of shit best friends do. The neighborhood was a mixture of gay and Russian, and they kept a civil peace. Russians never acted gay, gays never acted Russian, probably because of those atrocious hats. One of the more fun things we learned was that if you didn't want something anymore, you could just leave it on the sidewalk and the Russians would scavenge it before you even got back upstairs. Dump it and run. An old couch, broken TV, table missing a leg, just leave it out for the Russians. Once as a gag, my mother filled my apartment with at least 60 or 70 inflatable bunny rabbits that were being jettisoned after Easter at the dollar store. I came home from the road and I was too tired and irritable to find it funny. It was late at night and I just wanted to crash. So I just started throwing them over the railing to the sidewalk. Within 20 minutes, every single one of them had been adopted by the Russians. So afterwards, Mother and I started occasionally leaving shit out for the Russians just to see what they would and wouldn't take, to find their limits. The inflatable sex sheep went fast. A $5 bill smeared thick with Vaseline also went with a little more trepidation. But the Russians took everything eventually. I can't imagine what their hordes looked like compared to Mother's. Mother got a commercial agent and soon booked a Subaru commercial. Not only was that cool as fuck and a legitimate gig, it could also have meant real money for her. I still don't know exactly how commercials work, but I knew back then if it ran a lot, it could mean serious bank. This commercial didn't and wasn't, but by the time we knew that, we'd already celebrated and didn't care. It was a legitimate credit. I get an audition for a hidden camera show for the Fox Network.
I'd cut my hair, which I'm sure helped stop me from getting pegged for the stoner surfer roles I used to get inundated with. I fucking love hidden camera when it's done well. We grew up on candid camera and couldn't get enough. Later, shit like Ashton Kutcher's Punked sickened me with its lack of creativity and smarmy tone, but I'd still watch it even if only to make me angry. The Fox audition was the first one that didn't make me squirm in the guts. Instead of reading tripe in front of bored phonies, I'd get to come up with my own gags to film on Hollywood Boulevard using just hidden eyeglass cam. We went to a mailing service and tried to have a package shaped like a cat wrapped in tinfoil shipped. My ex-girlfriend's been bitching at me that she wants her cat back. Oh, you're going to get your cat back, all right. I stood in front of McDonald's and offered people a free Big Mac as part of a promotion. All they had to do was sign a contract that I'd printed up in thick legalese, selling their soul to the devil. We got shooed out pretty quickly by the McDonald's people, but not before we had enough footage to get me the job. I'd have my own segment on every show called Beware of Doug that my friend comedian Henry Phillips wrote my theme song for. It was my first real TV show that wasn't just stand-up spots. I had a big head but only needed small hooks on which to hang my hat. Meanwhile, Mother landed a role in an independent full-length film called Memphis Bound and Gagged, co-starring with Betsy Brandt, now known as Walter White's shoplifting sister-in-law from Breaking Bad. It didn't pay, but it was a lead role in a serious production. Tamar Halpern, who was there the day Mother died, was the director. She wrote me a long email while I was writing this book, chronicling the time she spent with Mother over the years, a lot of things that I didn't know at the time or until I read it. I've broken it up throughout the book. It began with this movie. This is from Tamar.
Bonnie J. Kirk, a.k.a. Gladys. In analog times, actors submitted headshots through the U.S. Post. A landslide arrived daily at my doorstep during the casting of Memphis Bound and Gagged. Bonnie stood out immediately because she was old enough to play the part of Gladys, the Elvis fanatic aunt of the director, played by Betsy Brandt. That got her in the door along with a bunch of other old coots. Turned out she was the only one who could act. Under special skills on her acting resume, she listed, sober for 17 years and that ain't no blank. I can't remember the last word. I've tried to remember for years, given the haunting shit that happened later. That ain't no joke, or that ain't no small thing, or something witty, but I remember thinking, inappropriate. I brought her in anyway because there aren't that many old people willing to act for free. Turns out she stole the show. And she got all her outfits, spangly getups befitting an Elvis freak, even got her hair did as high as it would go, so she could really be the part. She was method. She would do her scenes as Gladys, a slightly tremulous and feeble-minded woman who was camera-shy and accidentally charming. When I'd call cut, she'd come over and tell me why one of the other actresses was a cunt. Her character was a gentle, addled woman who claimed her son was a result of a night with Elvis, but who was wholly afraid to say it on camera. Between takes, Bonnie told us bawdy stories from the pages of her own checkered past as a nurse and a truck driver, an alcoholic mother, an ex-wife. She was a revelation. She nailed the role. She made us nervous. The switch between her character and her real self was such a gaping stretch, we didn't know how to respond. That first week, while 20 of my cast and crew traveled through Paso Robles, Bakersfield, and other glorious locations, she pressed Doug's first comedy CD into each of our palms, begging, nay, insisting, demanding, with those blue eyes that were not afraid to laser point, that we listen. Now. I will, Bonnie. Soon. Let me get through making my first film, I'd say as nicely as I could. He's fucking brilliant, swear to God. Her truck driver's swagger and refusal to accept that anyone on the film was too busy to listen finally drove us on the fourth night of filming to say, fuck it, we gotta get her to shut up about her stupid son. So we throw Doug's CD in the van stereo. With Bonnie safely in the other van, we could listen without her eagle eye. We assumed it would be mediocre at best. We didn't want a fake laugh through it in front of her. For all her toughness, it was clear her baby was her everything. And she was obviously delusional because every mother thinks her son shits diamonds. I think mine does, so I get it. The first bit on the CD was about Bonnie. We gasped because it wasn't very flattering. It was hilarious. We laughed, cried together hysterically. Me, the AD, the DP, a couple of the actors, and we shrieked, "That's Bonnie's vagina he's talking about." We couldn't fucking believe it. Bonnie was right. Her son was fucking brilliant at her expense. And she was proud. Shouted from the mountain proud. We could barely look her in the eye when the two vans pulled up and we tumbled out, telling her we heard the first 20 minutes and we were huge instant fans. "Yeah," she said, beaming. "Isn't he fucking brilliant? And he was talking about you, your cats, your Polaroids of your cats, your insistence that people look at your Polaroids of your cats. You watched his porn." "Yeah." She didn't care what Doug was talking about. Her being in his routine was just a byproduct. She just wanted people to hear what he had to say. She was the best publicist a son could ever ask for. It was weird and refreshing. I felt like I finally understood her. She wasn't an act. She was real, and fuck anyone who didn't appreciate it, especially that one cunt actress. Week 2, Bonnie saw I was starting to fall apart. Stupid boyfriend stuff. She caught me lying on a bench outside the restaurant where we were having dinner after a long day on the road. In 2 seconds, she had me sitting between her legs while she massaged my shoulders and neck expertly. It was exactly what I needed, and I told her so. "Oh, no," she said, waving me off. "You don't know. I've had this exact fantasy that someday I'd be on set, acting in a movie, and the director would need a massage." I think she almost teared up. It made me nervous and made me love her.
I knew none of these details at the time. Most of my conversations with Mother about her movie revolved around all the negative aspects, the driving and the traffic and the people who are hard to work with. She loved to complain. Her complaining sounded like my act without the jokes, but I could still tell she was thrilled to be doing it. I was just happy that we both had projects and that the whole idea of moving her to LA might be paying off.
My first experience with real television production was like my first dog, Otis. Bright, fun, and uncomplicated. Subsequent ones were stupid, blundering, and didn't like me all that much. The show, originally called When Hidden Cameras Attack, featured large-scale gags on sets mostly, but my segment was strictly guerrilla shit like my audition had been. I had my own producer, Jerry McKean, a Brit who was also a drinker like me. The head of Rocket Science Labs, the production company, was Chris Cowan, and Chris was a dude, not a suit. Baseball hat, Cleveland Browns fan, lived for taking chances, even if he knew it would probably never make the air. We'd pitch ideas just like comics at a bar. When we had enough pranks greenlit, Jerry and I would fly out on the road with a cameraman and a pocket full of rough ideas and just start shooting shit. It was primarily an eyeglass camera that the camera guy would rig me up with, and if necessary, he could back it up with a briefcase camera for secondary shots. If the ideas weren't working, we'd hit the bar at the end of the day and come up with new ones. Completely rogue. No crew, no oversight, just 3 fuck-ups with toys. A lot of shit would never see the light of day. In Austin, we did a petition drive on the UT campus to change the name of the tower to the Charles Whitman Memorial Tower. Whitman was famous for killing 16 people with a sniper's rifle from the observation deck of the clock tower in 1966. I said we were with the NRA and wanted to commemorate Whitman's incredible aim. Of course, that never aired, but Chris Cowan still found the footage of people going batshit hilarious. Doing it primarily with the eyeglass cam, it was important to make that single shot as engaging and active as possible. We'd go to thrift stores in the morning and look for props I could hold up in the shot, and then reverse engineer it from there. We even borrowed a baby and brought it into tattoo shops,